Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm here today with a very special guest. We have Mr. Jeff Porter. Jeff is the person who basically runs the wine programs or oversees the wine directors at all of the Vitali Bastianich New York restaurants, which includes Del Posto, New York Times four-star restaurant, Babbo, Lupa, Otto, Italy, maybe not the Italy, and more. Jeff, welcome to the show. It's really exciting to have you here.
Thanks a lot, Joe. This is awesome.
Well, was I missing any restaurant in New York?
Did you say Esca?
I didn't say Esca, and
Esca.
And Esca as well. So perhaps I mean I think that Del Posto is probably it's the greatest Italian wine list that I've ever seen. Most comprehensive, just extraordinary selection of Barolo. The Piedmont wines are just are awesome. I can't begin to say how much I think that's just such a great program. But before we talk about how great the programs you oversee and what you do and what your life is like, we'd like to start out with the best wine we've had in the last week, and I'll give you a chance to think about it. My best wine in this past week, and this is the first time that I'm going to ever say Bordeaux, because I tend not to drink a ton of Bordeaux, but this was given to me as a gift.
Is there a webcam so I can be like, whoa?
No, there isn't. Well, maybe we should install a webcam. You can see Jeff's just amazed expression. It was a bottle of 1990 Levangile, a right bank Bordeaux. It was so elegant and pretty and not what I'd expect. So it was awesome. And my girlfriend Alyssa and I made a venison out of downtown Italian, my first time cooking venison. And it is actually super easy. I'd encourage you guys to do it. It is like one of the most wine-friendly meats. It is pricey. It's like an expensive-ass piece of meat, like $30 plus a pound. But
you didn't shoot it.
We didn't shoot it. Yeah, if you shoot it, then... And coming from a Texan, he's like, you didn't shoot that thing? it was awesome. So it's in downtown Italian with Bordeaux. I mean, that was some good living on a Sunday night.
What was the vintage?
1990.
Nice.
And this was a crazy thing. So it was a gift. It was from one of my friends and one of our investors. He was like, I don't know about this wine. Like, there's no label on it. That I could tell what bottle it was by the foil, by the capsule. But we didn't know what vintage it was until we took the foil off. It was like, whoa, 1990. That's awesome. And it was pretty damn delicious. Have you? Okay, I've given you some time to think. Yeah, what's the best?
Well, I wanted to listen to you. I'd gotten my mind thinking about it, and last week the best wine I had, it was the first time I'd ever had this producer, and I actually never heard of him, but I've been told it's kind of one of those hard to get wines because he stopped making wine in 2005, is Jackie Truchot Martin. It was a Gevi Chambertin. It was Premier Cru, but we drank a lot of wine that night, so I don't remember what it was, but it was 88 was the vintage.
Wow.
And you know, working in the restaurants I work, I actually don't have a lot of opportunity to try Burgundy or Bordeaux or anything outside of Italy, except for Champagne. I mean, cry me a river, right? But it's fun to try wines from other places that you're not as familiar with. And it was so beautiful. It was just really pretty. and we had a rabbit stew, and it was fantastic.
Nice. This is homemade rabbit stew?
It was homemade. I didn't make it. I was at a friend's house with a group of other wine nerds, and yes. It was a good time.
All right, that sounds awesome. So, Jeff, tell us about your life. What is it like? What is your daily, your day to day? I mean, this you have to be one of the most powerful wine buyers of Italian wine in the country. You're overseeing these huge programs, thousands of selections just between Babbo and Del Posto alone. How do you manage your day to day? Tell us about what your job actually is.
I'm still trying to define it.
Right, because it's something that didn't exist before you. I remember when I worked at Babbo, there was no person who was overseeing multiple lists. Every house kind of took care of itself.
Right. And it's kind of a combination of that still. It's funny to say a most powerful buyer. And I mean, my job isn't really about buying wine anymore. It's more about guiding, and it's exciting because I'm really taking this position as a helping others. It's like the pay it forward wine director. I'm trying to teach people things that I was successful at and things mm-hmm. that I failed at in my career, so they can curate and create experiences for guests at various locales, between Lupa, the fun easygoing Osteria, to Del Posto, which is the, you know, still, I find it a lot of fun, but, you know, suit and tie kind of wearing sommelier gig. But the day-to-day is, it's different. I mean, the fun thing about the restaurant industry and the extremely stressful part is, as you know, is every day is different, be it an HR issue, being someone sick. I mean, our restaurants depend on bodies, human beings being there. And if one person's not there, you have to figure it out. And it could be you. Which could set your day back. Like right now, I'm doing a lot of work trying to in 2014. So I'm going through all the numbers, doing what I call the glamorous side of the wine business, the business part. You know, there's not a lot of wine tasting when looking through spreadsheets.
Yeah, staring at Excel until your eyes get blurry and...
You know, like, wow. I mean, I look at kids these days who, you know, there are classes about Excel in college, and I didn't get that, so it's just been a lot of trial and error to figure out how to do a formula.
Same here. Between European studies and food studies, I by the time I got my master's degree, I had no Excel experience at all before opening Del Anima.
And it definitely helps for all those listening. If you don't know how to use Excel, it's a very powerful program. Luckily, we have some people in our company in the accounting office who are very good at it, so they help us out when we get stuck. But my day-to-day, I look at a week, and depending on the week of the month, I'm deciding, you know, where I need to be, what I need to do. Obviously, at the beginning and the end of the month, it's all focused around inventory. I directly manage 5 restaurants. So within the Batali Bastianich group here in New York, I don't do anything with the Casamono or Bar Hamon in New York. I just work with the Italian restaurants. So I work with each of the head sommeliers or wine directors and organize their week for them with inventory, and I look at what they're doing. I try to meet with them weekly to kind of go over where things are going, what are some issues that we need to address, be it on the wine list, with HR, with service, you know, what they've been successful at, what they've not been successful at. So that's the kind of overall weekly duties that I need to accomplish. I try to meet with producers when they're in town and, you know, take them around and introduce them to the staff. And I love doing, my favorite thing to do is education. Once a month, we try to get all the sommeliers from all the restaurants together. So on Monday, we did a kind of a in-depth Barolo tasting. Mm. And there were 30 people, which is crazy to think. So there were 33 people, 3 people from another restaurant, a restaurant that was just right, Calique Leon Sons, right next door to Del Posto, so we invited their som team over.
And by the way, they just have an extraordinary wine list there. Yeah. Ryan is doing such incredible work.
That restaurant crushes it, and if you want to go drink well-priced aged wine, that's of that tier in New York, it's a place to go to.
definitely one of my favorite restaurants. And our director of operations, Heather, it's like one of her absolute favorite restaurants in the world. She'll see her there all the time. And not to out her, sorry, Heather.
Yeah, their like house beer is called Shift Drink. It's awesome.
And they make that themselves.
They do.
That's awesome.
All right.
So you'll get all these small A's together and a few friends, a few neighbors, and you'll go through an in-depth, is this a commune-by-commune tasting?
Well, so this one was, yes and no. I mean, this tasting was a focus on La Mora and Serra Lunga, and it wasn't versus. I don't want to put the word versus into the tasting because it's more, I wanted to show the extremes. You know, we're all taught in Barolo education that, you know, La Mora is the light, pretty, elegant side, and Serra Lunga is the big, brawny, powerful side. And it's rare to actually taste the wines in context mm-hmm. next to each other. So we did all 2008 vintages. We tried 7 wines, all cru wines, and I did modern and traditional producers and had everybody talk about them. We went in depth into, like, the soil chemistry and the idea of the different soil types in each of the regions, and then talked about crus. And then I really tried to lead a discussion about the wine. So I want the staff to talk about it. And the cool thing is to see disagreements. It's not arguments. It's healthy debate. You know, people like, well, I don't understand the aromatics, or I think this wine is aromatic, and they get into it. And having the younger sommeliers and the older sommeliers hear people's ideas and understanding the wine is moving the program forward as a whole.
And did the I don't want to say conventional wisdom, but did the preconceived thoughts on those communes kind of show through? Was La Mora indicative of what you'd expect for La Mora and Serra Lunga indicative, or was it more producers' styles showing through more?
La Mora, yes to both. I think what it showed everybody is that with it, the preconceived notions of the communes are definitely there. Serra Lunga, the Serra Lunga wines are big and brawny and powerful. Within the commune, the consistency it was there. Obviously, there are variations based upon producer and people that used, you know, new French oak versus Boti. There was a big difference, mm-hmm. but it was neat. I mean, the conventional wisdom did rain down, and it was like, yes, La Mora wines are much more aromatic, they're much more floral, and the Serra Lunga wines are much denser and darker, and you know, these were young wines, they were all 08s, but it was just so amazing to see them all back to back next to each other, which we rarely do, even when you taste
it's,
the vendors.
It's amazing how I'll find even Italian-focused sommeliers will be able to talk much more in depth about the Grand Crus of Burgundy than the communes of Barolo. And I think that it's because there is a wide range of producer styles, but doing something like that, I think, is super, super helpful. And it's a good way to parlay to a next conversation about La Festa di Barolo, which last year was held at Del Posto, and it was just this awesome event. I got to taste just extraordinarily well-aged wines. It's hard to find very old Barolo, I find, that is in really great condition. And you think about in the 60s and 70s, people were collecting Bordeaux and collecting Burgundy, but you didn't have that many great producers of Barolo at that time, and there wasn't this idea to collect them and age them and store them properly. And people brought out some pretty awesome examples. What's your involvement this year with the Festa? It's something that's based on the La Pole of Burgundy, and it's just, I think, an awesome event.
So Antonio and Venice Media graciously invited me back to kind of wrangle the sommeliers. It's definitely not leading, because when you invite sommeliers from all over the country who run the greatest wine programs of America, you're not leading anybody. Everybody has their own opinion, and we all work well together. And so this year it's at the Four Seasons in Midtown. Is that Midtown?
That's Midtown. Okay.
I've only lived here 4 years, so I'm not sure in my geography. I rarely get above 23rd Street. I go to Esca, and that's 43rd and 9th. I go there and come straight back. You know.
Yes. And you live in Brooklyn.
I live in Brooklyn. I do. I love it.
I understand that.
So this year's La Festa is this is the third iteration, and being held at the Four Seasons. So myself and another sommelier named Colin, we're wrangling the sommeliers to work the event. And Festa del Barolo is a 2-day event, one day being the grand gala, where there's 15 or 16 producers coming this year. Each of them have a table, and they bring cool wine, and then everyone who comes is invited to bring amazing wine. The coolest thing about Festa del Barolo is seeing the producers taste wines their parents made or their grandparents made, and they've never seen before.
Right.
And, you know, you'll look at them, and like Roberto Conterno of Giacomo Conterno, the first time his eyes were just like, oh my goodness, I've never seen this wine before. I have pictures of it. And he tasted it, and he's like, my mind's blown. He's like, I'm going to go back to the winery and figure out, you know, why and the X, Y's, and Z's of this wine. It's amazing to see.
It's awesome. Because you're a small producer, your chances are you're not holding on to stock. You need to sell it out to pay your bills. Some larger producers, medium-sized producers, or people who have a long history of saving wine might do that, but it's super rare. So a special thing. And I just love that the types of producers it attracts to the city who might not otherwise be traveling. You have some winemakers who really enjoy traveling and who are good at it and speak English, and it's part of what they do. But then you have others who just want to be at the winery. I think of Giuseppe Rinaldi, mm-hmm. who came a couple of years back, and he's been imported to New York since the 70s, and that was his first trip in like 30 years or something. And to see him here and talk to him in person, he's, you know, just an extraordinary wine producer. He's pretty special.
Yeah.
Who are you excited that's coming to this year's?
You know, he came. It was the first time he'd come to the United States for a long time. It was Paolo Scavino, and I actually haven't had a chance to talk to him because I mainly talk with Aliza, his daughter, mm-hmm. and so I'm excited to talk with him again and get into the nitty gritty of his winery and his vineyards again, because there's been a shift in their winemaking style, and it's interesting, and I want to talk to him about that, and I know his daughters are kind of leading that.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a historical estate, and he's a really neat, nice guy. And
yeah, I have to say, the last time I tasted Paolo Scavino wines, I noticed they're just more they're more exciting than they used to be. And they're always a top quality producer, but and then making just these very like elegant, pretty, age-worthy, smooth wines. But now there's kind of this energy and excitement in them that I didn't notice before, and I can't really place my finger on. But I'd love to find out what some of those changes are as well.
I mean, I know in speaking with Elise, and I've been to the winery a few times, you know, they've decrease the amount of barrique,
mm-hmm.
New and old. They're moving a lot to Boti and longer macerations. So they're kind of the pendulum swinging, just like we're seeing across the world and specifically here in the United States with the pursuit of balance. And, you know, people are taking their time they've had time to figure out what's right, what's wrong. I always call Italy the newest, oldest wine region in the world, because obviously they've been making wine forever, but they had to figure things out post-World War II, and to go back to like why there aren't a lot of old wines anywhere, even in some of the greatest estates, you'd think they'd hold libraries back, is post-World War II, Italy was super, super poor. And, you know, even through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it wasn't until the 90s where people started seeing money in wine. And so the grandparents and parents were, sell everything. You can't hold on to anything. There's this idea, and still in Piedmont today, even though they're much more like Burgundy, and they're farmers, but they're driving nicer cars than, you know, your soybean farmer might, or your wheat farmer. But they have a hard time getting over that thing where if I hold it, you know, there may not be a tomorrow, so I need to sell everything so I can make sure I have enough money to pay my bills.
Makes sense when you live through the war years, mm-hmm. right? And your normal everyday life is just upended and kind of thrown on its head. We do need to take a quick break. Before we go, though, tell us, what are the dates of the Festival? Is it possible still to buy tickets?
I believe there are a few tickets available. You can go to venicemedia.com, and it's February 6th and 7th.
And the 6th is the dinner and a tasting on the 7th.
Correct.
Okay, great. So go to venicemedia.com. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Jeff Porter of the Vitali Bastianic B&B Group.
This one's called Manufactured Consent by Mamarazzi. This is In the Drink on Heritage Radio Network. Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we're back with Jeff Porter, who oversees the wine programs at Del Posto, Babbo, Esca, Otto, and Lupa here in New York City. Jeff, I want to talk with you about the state of the American sommelier, because when we both started in the industry, it was very different than how it is now. I think both of us kind of just, we sort of fell into it. It wasn't what we thought we were doing. You grew up in Texas, moved to California, and first let's start with how did you get into it when you got to California?
Well, I got into wine while I was in college at the University of Texas, and it was I had worked at a restaurant before I turned 21, and the chef there it was a small little German restaurant, and pounding schnitzels is what I did, literally. He would give me a glass of wine every night, and I found it really interesting, and he would tell me stories about it, and so I got some books, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. And being a nerd, you know, in a glass of wine or a bottle of wine, you've got science, art, geography, meteorology, any ology and any academic study, I think you can distill down into 750 milliliters of grape juice. And so I started reading more and more and more. And then there was a wine shop in Austin that I really liked. And before I turned 21, I just started going, hanging out there and being like, hey guys, I'll move boxes for you. And they, on my 21st birthday, January 21st, 1998, I got a call and said, hey, come to a wine tasting. It was the GM. So I went to this wine tasting. It was for Santa Barbara Wines at the Omni Hotel in Austin, Texas. Met Lane Tanner. I remember tasting those wines. And the GM walked around with me. And one of my favorite wine expressions, this really tall, like 6'7", 290-pound linebacker or defensive end, wine salesman named Lou bent over and he's like, "You smell that, boy?" And I'm like, "Yes, sir, I smell that." I had no idea what he was talking about. He's like, "That dog can hunt." And wow. I think that's the best wine expression I've ever heard in my life. But
what does it even mean?
It must be good. that's how I took it. I mean, if that dog can hunt, that means the dog's good at, you know, hunting, which is good for us Texans. And
I love that. It's not growing up in Queens. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
They offered me the job, and I just worked a few days a week, 4 hours a day, and I just moved boxes. And, you know, I was around a lot of, you know, seasoned wine professionals, and I just became super geeked out. And I wanted to go to med school, and I'd taken the MCATs, and I applied to medical school. And when time came, they said, "Hey, do you want to be the beer buyer?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I want to be the beer buyer. I'm 21 years old." And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to be the coolest person in my apartment building." And that's how I fell into it. And then, you know, moved to California, and it kind of snowballed from there. But
it's crazy. There are so many parallels in what you do currently and what I do and how you got into it. And for me, it was a month after my 21st birthday. I walked into Italian Wine Merchants, and I was like, "This is the coolest freaking place I've ever been to," with their saloomerie in the back and the dumbwaiter that got the wine from the cellar, even though I bought, you know, $15 bottle of Feudi di San Gregorio Rubrato, and they like wrapped it up all nice for me, and it's like, I love this place. I just want to be here. And I was like, what can I do to be here? And same thing. Didn't think I'd ever, you know, started in that. And you worked for a distributor, right?
I worked for a distributor. Then I moved to Napa, and I worked at a restaurant there. And then I did corporate retail. And then I got in with the BB Batali Bastianich Hospitality Group in Los Angeles with Osteria and Pizzeria Mozza,
which are absolutely freaking awesome restaurants. They're just so extraordinarily good. And so you were there for about a year and a half, and then came over. Then
they shipped me east.
Shipped you east. So now you oversee about 30 sommeliers. What is the, you know, when you started in the late 90s, I was a little bit after you. That a sommelier wasn't what it is today. It's a different thing. There, sommeliers are kind of, if you dine out often, and there are some household names of sommeliers. How do you think that this affects the young sommeliers that are applying for jobs with you? Are you seeing just a lot more excited people, and it's a profession now, and it attracts so many different people? Are the expectations out of whack or in line? What are you seeing?
I think it's all of that, and it's a double-edged sword. It's kind of, I equate it to what happened in the late 90s, 2000s with like the Food Network. You know, celebrity chefs happen. You know, there's Emeril Lagasse and Bobby Flay and Mario Batali. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be a chef. And they just see these guys on TV and the women on TV cooking and making money and doing neat, cool things and not realizing how long it took to get there and the hard work that it takes to get there. And I think you're seeing the same thing now today in the wine industry. You know, Raj Parr didn't become Raj Parr yesterday. It's taken him 20 years of extremely hard work, dedication. I've known Raj for a long time, and he is one of the hardest workers I've ever met in my life. And, you know, and taking those opportunities that were around him and recognizing the good and the bad and moving forward is what's led to a lot of his success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a lot of the kids now, you can go to school, you know, there's the Master Sommelier program is a lot, or the Court of Master Sommeliers is a lot bigger than it was, you know, when I started out. You know, there's so much information. The public, you know, even now recognizes, here's the good part. Is being a sommelier, when I first started out, my parents were like, "A sommelier? Is that a real job? Okay, we're going to let him live his fantasy, and then he'll go to med school." And now, you know, it's a profession. And just like being a chef is now considered a profession, which is great. But I think, conversely, the sharp end of that double-edged sword is that the expectations for some of the young sommeliers are that, you know, they can come out, because they know all the Grand Crus or all the Premier Crus of Champagne and Burgundy can rattle off all the classified growths of Bordeaux, that they can manage a wine program, lead people, deal with guests who are much older than them, may have more experience or may not, and understand how to work a table. And kids come in and they're like, you know, I don't need to learn from you. Yeah. You know, I don't need to learn. It's not even learning from me, but it's learning from the captains. Like, the captain that I work with, you know, when I work the floor at Del Posto, when I used to do it every night, I learned so much about service from him and hospitality. And I think a lot of people forget that when you're a sommelier, it's the hospitality industry first, and wine's just one of the cool things we get to do.
Right. I find that I've, in some ways, forgotten so much about wine knowledge. When before we opened El Anima, I'd done the diploma at the WSET, and I was doing the court, and I did this other program called Society of Wine Educators. I was like a certified wine educator. And I had all of this like awesome, all these wine facts stored up in the back of my head, and now I've forgotten most of them. But I'm better at making guests happy. And that's the essence. That's what it is. It doesn't matter if you have every tool in the shed if you don't know how to use them. And yes, I couldn't agree more that I've learned about service over the years and making guests happy. And that's the only industry we're in. We're not in the industry of memorizing every fact and spewing it out at a guest to impress them. So that's really interesting. And what advice would you give young sommeliers, other than to read Raj Parr's book, which is pretty awesome, Secrets of the Sommelier?
I think humility, patience. You know, here in New York, it's interesting. You know, by the time I'd gotten to New York, I'd already been selling wine for 15 years. And within like the first 5 months, I had tasted wines that I'd only read about. And, you know, the young sommeliers here in the city, if you're working at, you know, almost any restaurant that has a sommelier team, are drinking wines that, or tasting wines, hopefully not drinking them, but maybe drinking them at home with their friends, that most people only dream of. And so my biggest fear for a lot of the sommeliers is not staying grounded, but you have to have that appreciation of that $10 bottle of wine, just like you have for that $1,000 bottle of wine. Because at the end of the day, the majority of the wine that you're going to sell, no matter where you're at, is going to be on the more value-centric side. So you have to be able to appreciate what that wine is for what it is.
Even at Del Posto?
Yeah. you have to understand. I mean, we're not necessarily going to sell you a $10 bottle of wine. I don't think there's not even a $10 glass of wine to be found at Del Posto. But you've got to understand that if a guest is going to come in, like I always use the example, my wife and I, before we were married and we were dating, we both really like food, and experience is what we've always strived. We don't get each other gifts. We get each other experiences. And so to have certain experiences when you're young, you save your money, and then you go when you have that experience, be it travel or whatnot. And for us, it was dining. So the first time we came to New York, we went to Danielle, and this was in 2005. And, you know, I made no money. She made no money, but we saved a lot of money. And it was a very expensive meal for us. But everybody there made us feel great. And, you know, my knowledge of wine then was pretty base, and I knew what I could afford, and I explained that to the sommelier, and because the sommelier was a professional and understood that, they brought me the greatest wine I could afford. Because I couldn't explain DRC, I couldn't talk in that league. So if those guests come to any of our restaurants, be it Lupa's in Osteria or Del Posto as a 4-star restaurant, if someone says, I want, you know, is it Trapiche? A Malbec. You know, that they normally get at their...
Tres Picos, so that one?
Maybe Tres Picos, but there's a Trapiche, I think. I don't know.
Trapiche.
But they say they want a Malbec that they find normally at their grocery store. You need to understand that, not just from an intellectual book-read kind of experience, but you need to be able to decipher that in the right fashion so you make them happy. Because that's all it's about.
Yes.
The one reason I left corporate retail and the distributor world was the instant gratification that you get from restaurant work. You get to see when you make someone happy, and it's so much fun, and it fills you with joy and excitement. And I've made so many friends by serving people. And that's exciting.
Did your boss at the distributor have the same conversation with you that mine did with me when I worked for a distributor, saying, "What, are you crazy? No one leaves working for a distributor to go work the crazy restaurant hours that are in a restaurant. Everyone does it the other way. You're going backwards, Jeff." Did you have that conversation?
I had that exact same conversation. Yeah. they're shaking their head. They're like, "Why are you doing this?" And I was like, "Because I want to make people happy immediately."
Yes. Yeah. It's something that has been making a lot of people happy immediately that you've been doing, and I've been following you on Twitter, and I cannot believe that you're getting away with this. The $5 for $5 at Del Posto. And you talk more about this. You're pouring just amazing wines and you're just giving it to people. It's almost like the $5 is a technicality that you have to charge something.
Well, you can go to Subway and get your $5 footlong, or you can come every other Saturday at Del Posto and get 5 unique wines and kind of led by one of the sommeliers of Del Posto in a discussion. So in May, it'll be 2 years that we've been doing this. So we started two Memorial Days ago. And so the whole idea, Jeff Katz, the GM, and I were trying to think, like, how can we make Del Posto as approachable as possible on the wine side? And the idea was like, well, at first the idea was to call it community wines, like this community-based thing where people could come and try some neat wines for just a little bit. And then we were like, well, it's 5 wines, $5. That sounds more fun, 5 for $5. So the whole idea is to introduce our sommeliers, introduce these wines that, you know, sometimes they're really rare and sometimes they're just really unique. And it's not about the money. It's just about the experience and giving people that opportunity to taste wine. So it's an hour long. There's always a theme. So be it like the last one we did, the last Saturday before Christmas, we do one that's champagne, and I always host that one because I love champagne. And so it's 5 champagnes. They're super unique, and we talk about them. And my whole goal for 5 for $5 is to get the guests to talk to me. Now, it's not a top-down discussion. I want them to be able to build their wine vocabulary so when they go to a restaurant or go to a retail shop, they're curating the experience the best way possible for them because they're making the investment. We're invested in them emotionally, but it's a business transaction for us. We've got a lot of people that we're emotionally invested in from a business standpoint and our emotion. But we've got a, you know, as a wine buyer myself, as an individual who buys wine and drinks it at home, I want to make sure I'm getting the best bang for my buck. And by knowing more, I'm able to do that for myself. And I always like to teach people, if you don't like a wine, let's talk about it. So we pour wines, and I always ask, who doesn't like this? Okay, let's talk about that. Because you need to remember that, so when you come to me as a sommelier, you can say, I really don't like this kind of style. These are the things I don't like. And automatically, I've eliminated X, Y, and Z, so I can make sure I'm going to try to make the best experience for you. And it's tons of fun, and the people we get are excited.
What's the next one you have coming up?
This Saturday. And the theme, unfortunately, is TBD. I got to talk to my wine director at
mystery.
Del Posto. It's a mystery.
And is there a way to sign up, or do you just show up?
You just show up. It starts at 1 o'clock. So it'll be this Saturday, which is the 10th, at 1 o'clock at Del Posto.
It's like the absolute bargain. I mean, to have those extraordinary wines and the time of your you know your beverage team is for an hour for $5. It just blows my mind that you're able to get away with this.
There are values in New York.
It's truly
not just
awesome.
At your bodega.
All right, Jeff. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, Joe, to have you on the show. Awesome. Before we go, I need to plug a couple of things that we have coming up on January 17th. We're going to have our Amphora wine classes are starting up again. We oversold our last one on Amphora aged wine, so we're doing that class over again because we had a long wait list, and there are still a few spots left for that. You can find me at the Festa di Barolo on February 6th. I'll be there for the dinner. February 7th, however, we have our annual Eat, Drink, and Bloody Mary contest that we're holding at Lepicho, and hope to see you there. All right, thanks so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.